today on Against the Grain, part two of my interview with the sociologist Fred Block about his book, The Power of Market Fundamentalism. Plus, we revisit a conversation with Nicholas Lampert about his book, A People's Art History of the United States. I'm C.S. My guests share their insights into Malthusianism, state intervention, art, and activism, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Recently, we presented an interview with Fred Block about the ideas of the English thinker Thomas Malthus and the role those ideas played in two major efforts to dismantle government aid to poor people. One of those efforts, which targeted the poor law in England, took place in the early 19th century. The other culminated in 1996 in the U.S. when Bill Clinton signed the law that famously ended welfare as we knew it. Thomas Malthus wrote an essay on the principle of population that was published in 1798, and that, according to Fred Block, spurred England's rulers to demolish the centuries-old welfare system codified in the Poor Law. According to Block, Malthus drew upon an apocryphal story told by Joseph Townsend about goats and dogs achieving a kind of population equilibrium on an island in the South Pacific. Almost two centuries later, in 1984, the conservative intellectual Charles Murray revived and deployed Malthus's ideas in an effort to discredit and dismantle the federal welfare system in the U.S., a system that had been established in 1935. Today, we present part two of my interview with Fred Block, together with a bit of overlap for the benefit of listeners who didn't get to hear part one. Fred Block is a sociology professor at UC Davis and co-author with Margaret Summers of the book The Power of Market Fundamentalism, Karl Polanyi's Critique. We pick up with Fred Block sharing these thoughts about Thomas Malthus and his ideas.
I mean, Malthus is to this day remembered as the founder of the study of population, demographers, the group of social scientists who focus on population dynamics, consider him the founding theorist of the field. And many people will remember learning about what Malthus argued about the fundamental law of population, that human population will grow geometrically, but the food supply grows just arithmetically, meaning that human population is always at danger of outrunning the food supply. That's the part of Malthus which most people remember. But when you sit down and you read through the whole essay, it becomes clear that the essay is a polemic against the way the old poor law worked, and that essentially what Malthus says is that the conventional view, the standard view on which the poor law policy is based, is that there's this poverty and that everybody agrees had been growing in the last decades of the 18th century. I mean, we know that at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there's a lot of economic displacement, that there are crafts that are employ a lot of people that are rising and falling. And so the number of people who are dependent upon this safety net system has been rising. I mean, that's the context in which Malthus is writing. And so he says that the conventional view is that there's poverty and then we have the poor law to alleviate poverty. And he says this is precisely wrong. The reason that England has so much more poverty than the countries in continental Europe is precisely because the poor law is itself the problem. The poor law is encouraging people who shouldn't be having families and having children to reproduce. And so it's contributing very directly to population growth that is in excess of what the English economy can support at that point in time.
A key theme that keeps coming up in this chapter is the preference for natural law, the laws of nature, understanding, Malthus understanding that the laws of nature governed human society as opposed to the laws of people, the laws made by humans. For example, the poor law, legislation that would be imposed, maybe in his phraseology, on people and maybe upset that natural balance. Can you talk about how important it was to Malthus that things be understood in naturalistic terms in a way that would view social laws, political laws, as a kind of interference?
The poor law for Townsend and for Malthus represented this artificial insertion by government, by politics, into the sphere of nature. And what Townsend and Malthus said is that if we eliminate that artificial interference, by which he meant giving poor people assistance so that they could buy food and maintain a shelter, that if we eliminated that assistance and returned to the previous, more natural state, which they claimed existed at a moment, earlier moment in history, then the same natural process that had created the balance between goats and dogs on the island in the South Pacific, that same natural law would essentially eliminate the problem of excessive amounts of poverty. And it would do that because the poor would essentially be able to see without any confusion the laws of the market. They would be able to see that the only way in which you could get food is if you worked for it. And so they would learn to have the self-discipline and drive to get a job, keep a job, and earn the money to escape poverty.
In their book, The Power of Market Fundamentalism, Fred Block and Margaret Summers point out that Malthus's arguments about what the poor law did to poor people, about how the poor law made poor folks behave, were not supported by any empirical evidence. But that did not stop Malthus's writings from fueling England's move from a system of poor relief to a much harsher, more stingy, and in fact punitive regime in 1834. And it also didn't stop Charles Murray from drawing on Malthus's ideas in Murray's 1984 book, Losing Ground. Fred Block told me that the argument Murray and Malthus made was that
liberals, do-gooders, they think that they're helping the poor by giving them this free assistance. But in fact, what we know is that they're making things worse because they're making people dependent. They're sending them the wrong messages. And so they're intensifying the poverty that they wanted. So a well-meaning policy has the perverse consequence of making poverty even worse. So the right has used this perversity thesis to argue that almost any form of government assistance, I mean, some people, we saw that in the Romney campaign when he talked about the 47% of people who are takers, that they're all welfare chiselers, whether they earned their Social Security or whatever government pension they might have gotten. And what this has led to is kind of this trope that giving poor people money will hurt them. And what's important to emphasize here is that particularly over the last 10 years, there's been around the world a very large-scale experiment with programs which are called cash transfers. Some of them are called conditional cash transfers. And programs were developed in Brazil and Mexico. Some of them started as paying poor families to keep their children in school, paying poor families something more to take their children in for pediatric checkups. But these programs have expanded, and some social scientists have estimated that there's something like 1 billion people, because the programs exist in India and China as well. There are something like 1 billion people who are receiving these kinds of cash transfers. And so we now have a growing body of empirical research. And lo and behold, when you give poor people in Mexico or Brazil or India or China some supplemental cash, it turns out that it makes their lives better. They're able to feed their families. They're able to make plans. They're able to invest in things, to make entrepreneurial choices. It doesn't, in fact, make them dependent and passive or encourage them to have more children or whatever. So we've been in the U.S. essentially making social policy kind of within this mythical view that giving people assistance is in fact something that hurts them. And so one more instance of this is that in terms of housing policy, the dominant model for dealing with homelessness has basically reflected this philosophy, essentially saying that most of the homeless have mental disorders or addiction problems. And so what we're going to do is that we're going to create programs for them. And once they deal with their problems and have gotten a job, then we'll get them a home. And that's been the dominant model of homelessness policy since the Reagan era. What's happened in the last few years under the Obama administration, starting with veterans, is that there's a new policy option, which is called Housing First, to deal with the problem of homeless veterans. And it's been implemented in many cities now. And essentially, the new policy is maybe a lot of the homeless do have mental health and addiction problems, but their real problem is that they're homeless. And so we're going to give them housing first, and then give them access to social services to deal with their other problems and to help them find work and so forth. And lo and behold, with veterans, the Housing First policy has worked. And a number of cities have declared that they've actually eliminated the homelessness problem among their veteran population. So the logical conclusion is that Housing First should be a general policy, not just for veterans, for all the homeless people, and that we no longer have to be so fearful of this basically 18th century idea that assisting people will make them worse off. Assisting them can make them better off and can directly address their most pressing problem, which is a lack of resources.
Yeah, these ideas, Malthus's ideas, Murray's ideas, have tremendous power. And that's another point you want to make in this book, which is the power of ideas to really sway people in critical circumstances. A lot of people know of the term regime change. Well, my guest Fred Block and Margaret Summers talk about ideational, as in ideas, ideational regime change, and how, you know, the thunderous consequences that have accompanied that in particular moments in history. So, Fred, we've really been focusing on one chapter of this book, The Power of Market Fundamentalism, that you co-authored with Margaret Summers. Can you give us a brief schematic of what else readers will find of interest in this book?
Well, we use the welfare case as a kind of example of the logics that have been used to shape public policy across a whole set of issues: financial policy, international trade policy, labor policy, all of these different realms, that the basic logic of the market fundamentalists is the same, that state action is artificial, arbitrary, and that it disrupts the natural logic of markets when they're left to themselves. And one of the main points that we're making, and this is where Karl Polanyi, who is a Hungarian refugee intellectual who wrote his masterpiece, The Great Transformation, and published it in 1944, that the core of the argument that he was making is that this idea that the economy is natural, that the market economy is natural, and that it exists as an autonomous structure independent of the state is a myth, that it simply doesn't understand the history and the reality. Essentially, his argument is that state action is required to construct and to maintain markets. And, you know, we know that because the state establishes property law and enforces it. It establishes contract law and enforces it. And so the idea that there's some kind of economy that exists away from the state and that what the state does is intervention in that separate sphere is all a kind of intellectual misconception, that the state is necessary to constitute the market. And so one of the points that we make is that even many on the left have kind of railed against one of the core policies of the right, you know, which they term deregulation, that essentially the claim is that financial markets, other markets were deregulated. And the market fundamentalists love that term because for them, deregulation is that they get the evil government out and they return that market to the natural order of things. And what we say is that that's, again, a category error to think of it as deregulation. What we're really talking about is re-regulation. So what happened in the financial sphere is that as a consequence of the lessons of the Great Depression, we had a set of financial regulations which were designed to protect consumers, protect the public against dangerous forms of speculation that could wreck the economy, that could gouge borrowers and so forth. And so what happened in the shifts in policies in the 1980s and 90s was not the deregulation of the financial sector, but the re-regulation in a way that essentially protected the giant banks and other financial institutions and took away the measures that protected consumers, protected the society from excessive amounts of speculation, and that it's re-regulation because the government was centrally involved. It rewrote the laws, it negotiated with the banks, and it was constantly telling the biggest banks and financial institutions that we know that you're too big to fail. And so if you come into crisis, don't worry, the Federal Reserve will bail you out. We'll figure out a way to make you survive. So essentially, deregulation makes it appear that these financial institutions and big corporations were out there in the wilderness doing their own thing. But the reality was that the government always had their back, was always intimately involved in their affairs, and ultimately did rescue almost all of the major players. I mean, yes, they let Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers go under, but everybody else was ultimately protected in the game. So that's why we're so insistent that the language, the ideas really matter, because deregulation appears like this return to a natural order, and it seems right. But we're saying, and Polanyi was saying, there is no natural order. The economy has always been socially and politically constructed. And the political lesson for us is that because it has been socially and politically constructed, it can be reconstructed in a way that doesn't just send all of the benefits to the top 1%, but rather in a way that creates an economy that's inclusive, that's egalitarian, that distributes the resources more fairly. that the myth of naturalism is a way of keeping the democratic public away from these key decisions that shape the economy. And the result of that naturalism is partly what has given us this increasingly unequal distribution of income and wealth. And the way that we can get back to a more equal distribution of income and wealth is by recognizing that the market is politically constructed and needs to be reconstructed.
That's Fred Block, research professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis, and co-author of The Power of Market Fundamentalism, Carl Polanyi's Critique, now out in paperback from Harvard University Press. We'll take a short break and return with a conversation with Nicholas Lampert about his book, A People's Art History of the United States. Please stay with us. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. We turn now to a conversation I had with Nicholas Lampert about his book, A People's Art History of the United States, which is out in paperback from The New Press. Shortly after the hardcover edition was released, I sat down in studio with Nicholas Lampert, who is an artist as well as a faculty member in the Department of Art and Design at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. I asked Nicholas about a group of artists and writers who came together in New York City in 1933 and called themselves the Unemployed Artists Group.
Well, they were looking to get employed by the federal government. They wanted positions in the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. And all these programs in the WPA weren't gifts from a benevolent government. Artists had to fight and demand that they get positions, and they did. And the Unemployed Artist Group started with 25 artists, and they essentially asked for plumber's wages to decorate some of the federal buildings and be put to work. And they won this demand. And more than that, they were also promoting for a federal art bill where they wanted permanent funding for the arts. They were very critical of the gallery system. They felt like only a handful of artists would ever succeed economically in that system. And they thought that if the federal government employed artists, that that would put many artists to work, but it would also make art public. It would make art accessible to people all throughout the country, in the smaller cities and rural areas. And they really critiqued kind of the same issues that we're looking at today, that there's a handful of art capitals, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago. And then the rest of the country is very much vacant of real economic opportunities for artists. So they argued that the government should put artists to work. And that led to the WPA Federal Art Project.
Tell us about the Federal Art Project and what it did and how many artists it employed and what kinds of work they did.
Well, the Federal Art Project began in 1935 and lasted to about 1943. And it didn't employ huge numbers of artists. It employed about 5,000 artists total, but all types of opportunities. What's most famous is the murals. When we look at post offices throughout the country, you see the murals. Artists were also just paid to paint. A whole generation of artists were saved. Artists like Jacob Lawrence, who's arguably the most famous African-American artist of the 20th century, was paid $24 a week simply to paint. To me, it's remarkable because it signified that the government and society felt artists were important, that art mattered, that artists can't necessarily survive economically if you're just thrown into the market, and that there's a real value to this culture. So someone like Jacob Lawrence was paid to simply create art. And beyond the opportunities of creating prints, it was a heyday for screen printing. It was a heyday for photography. Dorothea Lange, through the Farm Security Administration, was, and many others were sent out to document America and rural poverty and working conditions. But art centers were set up across the country to bring art to the masses. I wrote in my book that there was this project called the Art Caravan, where two artists were given a refurbished ambulance and they would drive out to rural upstate New York and they would set up an art exhibition in front of a library and give a lecture on art and have a poll asking people in that community if they wanted a art center to be built in their community. So it was really making art public and trying to bring more people into the fold and understand the importance of visual arts.
Were the art centers public galleries, municipal galleries?
They were public. I mean, these were federal places. And, you know, they existed in all over the country, in rural New Mexico, in Spokane, Washington, in Minneapolis, the Walker Art Center, which today is one of the most famous art institutions in the country, if not the world, started as a WPA center. And, you know, artists were organizing during this period. They were forming unions. The unemployed artist group turned into the artist union, which was putting forth demands which, you know, were shaping the economic and the political times in which they were working in.
The artist union, how often did they meet and how big did they get? And I imagine they expanded beyond New York City?
That's correct. In 1934, the artists, you know, they began as the unemployed artist groups. They changed their name in 1934 to the Artist Union. They had upwards of 700 members by 1934. They peaked up around 1,000 members, where if you think about it, there's about 5,000 artists in the WPA Federal Art Project. One-fifth of them are card-carrying Artist Union members. Their base was New York City. That's where their strongest membership was. They had weekly meetings where they'd have upwards of 300 to 400 people at each meeting. Whenever there was a crisis moment, a flashpoint, they'd have upwards of 700 people at these meetings. The artists' union spread up and set up other satellite organizations in Philadelphia, Boston, Baltimore, Los Angeles, Chicago, St. Louis, all over the country. But New York was really, really the heyday. And they were fighting. They were basically demanding the economic rights of the artists, and they were fighting the WPA cuts because those started coming down in 1936. By 1937, artists were being laid off this program. So there was massive lobbying and street demonstrations to keep their jobs and to demand that they still be employed.
Tell us about some of the demonstrations waged by artists' union members and their allies. For example, in New York City, in response to these cuts or pending cuts?
They employed direct action. When the cuts were sent to the offices in New York, these artists would occupy the offices, and they would be thrown in jail. They would be beaten. They were in solidarity with other unions as well. The artists' union wasn't just artists isolated, which is something we see way too often today. They would picket for other labor unions, and the maritime workers. What was remarkable to me is this is where artists really start to identify themselves as workers, that it wasn't just cultural work or, you know, it wasn't just this luxury product creating art and culture, something one does on the side. They identified as workers and that their role in society was truly unique. And they also looked far beyond the United States. 1937, the artists' union helped send two ambulances over to Spain as part of, you know, to fight against the fascists and Franco. They were putting forth all types of ideas. They called for a municipal art center in New York City. This would be a place to showcase artists, and one of the guidelines that the federal government put is, you know, it could only be for American-born artists. And they said, you know, we won't show in that place if that's the case. We have to allow artists from all over the world. They put forth an idea called the rental policy, which was stating that artists should be paid to show in museums, that it isn't enough just for the prestige to show in museums, that every time you show in a museum, you should be paid just like a musician is paid to play in a concert hall.
This was a common practice that artists whose work was being exhibited in a museum would not be paid?
They would not be paid. And that's a common practice today as well. You know, the economic situation for artists is grim. Most people who study art at a university or even graduate school, they have to find another line of work after a couple of years. And so what these folks were doing in the 1930s is really a model to learn from.
Nicholas Lampert joins us in studio. He is a Milwaukee-based artist and writer, and he's author of A People's Art History of the United States, 250 Years of Activist Art and Artists Working in Social Movements. It's published by the New Press. This is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. So, Nicholas, how do we account for this militancy? Were the members, the artists who joined the artists union, were they political radicals? Did they have a background in radical organizing and radical ideas?
Yes. A lot of these artists were affiliated with CPUSA, Communist Party USA. A lot of these artists were influenced by the times around them. The 1930s was a heyday for organized labor and strikes. Artists really looked to organized labor as a model of we will be more powerful if we unite together as artists, but also as you know, part of organized labor. And the artists union voted to apply for a charter with the AFL in 1935. 1936, they became part of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And that is a moment where artists are part of organized labor. And that came with the good and the bad. They're part of a larger structure. But the union in New York, which at this point, the artist union renamed itself the United American Artists Local 60, they were aligned. You know, it wasn't just artists that were part of this union. It was artists, bookkeepers, office workers, and insurance agents, which is something, you know, one would not imagine ever happening today. But they're part of a larger union, the CIO. But the higher-ups in the union didn't really understand how to best utilize the talents of these artists. Artists best when their creativity is let to flourish, where they can really use visual culture and enhance demonstrations. And so the higher-ups in the CIO told the artists union to curtail the massive demonstrations and the banners and the militancy, and also told them to meet once a month instead of once a week. And this really negatively impacted the energy of this union, and it fell apart. The role of the artists union, the CIO, fell apart after a year or so. Also at this time, you know, this is when the cuts were so severe from the WPA. So many people lost their jobs anyways. But the union, the CIO was saying, well, you could enter into the private sphere and be unionized artists. But you know, a lot of their militancy got lost. So the structure was interesting, but it didn't work for the long term in this case.
Let's bring your story in A People's Art History of the United States, and we're only focusing on a few chapters. There's so much information in this book, but if we bring your story forward to the late 1960s, and there is another bout of artist-inspired, artist-performed activism, you bring up the protests against the museum industrial complex. And you begin this particular chapter with a dramatic incident that occurred at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City on Halloween 1969. What happened?
Well, this was an action by two people, two artists, John Hendricks and Jean Touché, who collectively were called Guerrilla Art Action Group. And on October 31st, they walked into the museum, and they walked up to Casimir Malevich's painting, Supremist Composition, White on White, a once revolutionary work of art. Many people would look at it today as a very minimalist painting, but obviously tied to the Russian Revolution. And they walked up to the painting, took it off the wall, rested it on the floor, and stood there with a manifesto. And they said that the MoMA had distracted the public from the militarism that was taking place, the Vietnam War, and it distracted the public from the connections of the corporate interests on the Board of Trustees of the MoMA, that art wasn't neutral, that the Board of Trustees in the MoMA was, you know, dominated by the Rockefellers. And here you have this group of people trying to whitewash their name as being tied to fine arts and elite culture, yet they were the people behind the war machine in Vietnam, that Standard Oil and owning a lot of the companies that were manufacturing napalm. And I quoted these artists in the manifesto on that day that they said, "There is no justification for the enjoyment of art while we are involved in the mass murder of people." And that started their first intervention in the museum. They returned a month later.
This time the focus was on the museum's main lobby. What transpired?
On November 18th, John Hendricks and Jean Touché arrived with two other artists, Poppy Johnson and Sylvania. And they did an unsanctioned performance in the lobby of the MoMA, where they walked in unannounced. They had nice clothes on, suits. They had bags of beef blood underneath their suits. And without warning, they started screaming, slamming into each other, yelling as loud as they could. All of a sudden, the bags of beef blood burst, so their clothes are covered in blood. This performance went on for about 5 minutes until they were on the ground just in a puddle of this blood. They threw out 100 copies of a manifesto, which was titled A Call for the Immediate Resignation of All the Rockefellers from the Board of Trustees of the MoMA, which was connecting the dots between the board and militarism.
How did the museum respond to either the Halloween Day demonstration or this bloodbath?
That's interesting, because the higher-ups in the museum wanted to dialogue with them. When they saw these actions, this was new. This was new for artists to really target the museum as a site of protest. So it surprised the higher-ups in the museum, the director of the museum. And they were open to dialogue with them. They certainly didn't make any systemic changes at all. That performance bloodbath alone, when you look at the images and you read Gag's analysis of what happened, the audience didn't know that it was a protest. They thought perhaps it was performance art. Mm. So really blurring the lines. But Gag was interesting because they wanted nothing to do with the art world. They found that the art world was complicit, that it was tied to militarism, imperialism, capitalism. They felt that you had to picket it and really tear it down to reform it, that artists had to play a direct role in helping to structure the museum and to sitting on the Board of Trustees, that Board of Trustees couldn't just be dominated by the leaders of industry and business. They were also talking about the racial injustices and the sexism of the era. They asked the MoMA to establish a Martin Luther King, Pedro Albizu Campos Center for African American and Puerto Rican art. They asked the museum to reach out to African American and to Latino communities. But they were agitating. Gag was exceptional in agitating the power structure. They even asked, they requested that the director of the MoMA, John Hightower, have a press conference where he would pour a gallon of beef blood over his head and slowly repeat the line, "I am guilty, I am guilty, I am guilty." He didn't do that.
Speaking of artists of color, you cite in your book, A People's Art History of the United States, an actual quotation from the director of MoMA's Department of Architecture and Design, a guy named Arthur Drexler, saying, "There is no such thing as black and Puerto Rican artists." One can really understand why this generated so much outrage.
You can. And it really signified how exclusive these museums were. That not only were they a place that really highlighted artists who are white and male, you mostly had to be wealthy to have the opportunities to show in these museums. And Gag was really trying to, Guerrilla Art Action Group was really trying to bring that to public attention. And they did it in a creative and theatrical way. One action that I write about was a staged battle on May 2nd, 1970, where they did a battle on the streets right outside the MoMA, where John Hendricks and Jean Touché showed up in a limousine with signs around them. One said, Board of Trustees, the other, the director of the museum. Jean Touché was shouting out that quote that you just read. Battling those two was a large crowd of artists, the quote enemy, who are Black and Puerto Rican artists. Smoke bombs were going off in every direction. They set up a barricade in front of the entrance to the museum where the African American Puerto Rican artists were putting up Black Power flags and Puerto Rican independence flags. Police showed up, having no idea if this was a demonstration where they would have to come in and arrest people or if this was part of a MoMA performance. Jean Touché was lying in on the floor of the limousine, and a police officer said, "Is he dead?" And while John Hendricks is throwing smoke bombs and firing an imaginary pistol at everyone, I mean, this is unbelievable. It's really pointed critique, but it's using art and performance to really get at serious, serious issues. And I juxtapose that chapter, the Guerrilla Art Action Group, with Art Workers Coalition, which was another group that at the exact same moment was really agitating the museum as well.
Nicholas Lampert, he works with the Just Seeds Artists Cooperative. He teaches art and design at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. His new book is A People's Art History of the United States. Okay, so you were referring to the Art Workers Coalition, which was another art activist group formed in New York City. And this group also targeted MoMA, didn't they?
They did. They targeted MoMA, but they also targeted many other museums in New York City and beyond. This group was different, though, than Guerrilla Art Action Group because, you know, Guerrilla Art Action Group was specifically just a handful of people. Art Workers Coalition had 300-plus members, and any artist, filmmaker, critic, art administrator could join this group. And what also differentiated them, it was really split between those who had a stake in the art world and felt they could reform it and didn't want to, quote, sabotage their art careers because they wanted to be on good standing with the curators and administrators and those who really wanted to tear it down. And, you know, there was heavy hitters in this group. The critic, art historian Lucy Lepard, Faith Ringgold, Hans Hockey, Carl Andre, Robert Morris. Robert Morris, I cited him in my book saying, quote, "Museums are our campuses. Without artists, museums wouldn't exist." So they really targeted the museum as this was their site for protest. And they put forth demands to the museum. They really targeted MoMA. If the Vietnam War was symbolic of everything that was wrong with society, these artists targeted MoMA as everything that was wrong with the art world.
What were some of the demands they, I guess, initially directed at MoMA and then, I guess, out of that created a generalized set of demands?
Some of the demands they put forth was a list of 9 demands in 1969. These demands included artist representation on the Board of Trustees, where an artist would sit on that board, an artist curatorial committee, where artists would help decide some of the exhibitions. They also argued for 2 free evenings per week to make museums more accessible to working class people. Mind you, the MoMA is, what, $25 today just to enter? They wanted a creation of an artist registry so that the museum would serve as an advocate to help artists get other opportunities. They wanted artist control of their own work, meaning that if a museum collects your work, it doesn't just become their property. They wanted artists to be informed if their work could be in a certain show or what kind of context it would be in. They wanted a rental fee, which shows the trajectory of history and perhaps the knowledge that some of these artists had about the artist union in the 1930s and the demands that those artists put forth. They also wanted the museum to help advocate for the artists' economic well-being and also help them with housing issues. If we look today, it's increasingly difficult for artists to even afford to live in places like New York City, Los Angeles, and the Bay Area. So they felt that the museum should really safeguard the artists working today. They were really looking at race issues. They wanted a creation of an African American and Puerto Rican section of the museum It's odd to me that it was specifically Puerto Rican, not just generally Latino or Native or Asian American, but that was the demands that put forth. Obviously spoke to the power of the Black Power movement, the Young Lords, the influence that had over 60s radicalism. And they also wanted equal gender representation in exhibitions. Solo shows were almost exclusively men, male only. And they wanted more women, obviously, to have opportunities to show in these museums.
And I can think of at least maybe one of those demands that was implemented to the current day where, you know, some museums do have free admission at least once a month, right? The first Monday or whatever. Any other of those demands resonate in some sense with museum administrators?
Most of those demands fell on deaf ears. The two demands that actually made an impact was the one free day a week, and that did become adopted by many museums. You know, in the city I live in, for a long time, the free day was Monday morning, which makes it really inaccessible for working class people. Mm. There was also marginal improvement in the gender and race diversity. But you also saw in the 1980s the Gorilla Girls wheat pasting all the major museums, showing the statistics of how few women and how few artists of color were actually included in shows. So a lot of this fell on deaf ears.
In May 1970, the Art Workers Coalition called an art strike. What was this in response to, and what did the strike involve?
The art strike, actually, that's a short title. The long title of the art strike was the New York Art Strike Against War, Racism, and Repression. And this was a strike against the U.S. invasion of Cambodia and also the National Guard killings at Kent State and Jackson State. And this was asking the museums to shut down for one day, to be in solidarity with the anti-war movement. And they asked all the major museums and the galleries in New York City to close their doors and go on strike against the Vietnam War. And they had somewhat receptive audience to this. The Whitney closed down. The Jewish Museum closed its doors. And about 50 commercial galleries all closed down for that day. The MoMA didn't, but they waived their admission fee and screened an anti-war film program. The Guggenheim, which almost was an ode to guerrilla art action group, took their art off the walls and put it on the floor. But the Met, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, absolutely refused to listen at all to the Art Workers Coalition. And that day, most of the coalition targeted the Met and protested on the steps of that museum.
I'm sure the rationales for the museum's actions varied from case to case, but you know, do we have a sense of whether they agreed to this demand because of the concern of what the Art Workers Coalition would do if they didn't, or was it because that some of these administrators were politically aware and did understand the gravity of what was going on in Vietnam as compared with showing art to mostly rich people?
I think it's really complex, and without going straight into making a judgment, I think a larger notion is that a lot of these museums felt that the museum was a neutral space, that it wasn't a space that could make a comment about war, take a stand, either pro or against, that, you know, they were focusing simply on art and aesthetics, that this was their role, and that their role wasn't to critique and comment on war. What I thought the brilliance of the Art Workers Coalition and groups like GAG was they were really connecting the dots and saying art isn't neutral. When your board is dominated with people like the Rockefellers who have similar interests and stock in the machinery of war, that art isn't neutral, that those people choose the directors and that chooses what happens. And that's still the case today. When you see, you know, the theater in Lincoln Plaza in New York City named after Charles Koch? Or is it the David Koch Theater? You just see that influence and the power that people in these positions have to whitewash their name by using culture. But what I find interesting is some of the contradictions of a one-day strike and if that was actually a good tactic or not.
Tell me more.
Is that enough to ask a museum just to close down for one day? Does that absolve their responsibility? And is that enough? And is targeting the museum for a, you know, essentially a strike, it wasn't tied to organized labor. And it really showed the differences that occurred from the 30s to the 1960s. 1930s, the artists really identified with organized labor to the point that they became card-carrying union members. And it also talked about how much society had changed in 30 years. Artists had then fallen into the role as very marginalized, a counterculture movement, which is very much divorced from organized labor. One juxtaposition I show in my chapter was the Art Workers Coalition demonstrating on the steps of the Met. But there was also a hard hat demonstration of construction workers demonstrating against anti-war protesters and demonstrating against the counterculture. So you're really, it's the position of a very marginalized, important oppositional movement. But it wasn't the case where artists were forming, quote, unions or really, you know, aligned with, say, the workers of the Met.
And was there something about the background or the class composition of the artists that made blue-collar workers not necessarily able or willing to identify with these militant artists?
I would say that that was a reality. The artists were mainly coming from, you know, very white, male, coming from privileged backgrounds. I think there was a disconnection. But at the same time, it's so significant that these artists came together and organized. It radicalized them. It set many of these artists and art historians on a path of activism for their entire lives. The Art Workers Coalition weren't necessarily, quote, organized labor. Artists were scattered across every industry. Just like today, artists were, you know, working many jobs just to stay afloat and doing their art at night. But these actions mattered and they inspired others. I write about in that chapter that the Art Workers Coalition helped inspire MoMA workers to start a union. The PASTA union formed basically because it was inspired by the street demonstrations of Art Workers Coalition. They formed a union in June of 1971, where 112 out of 461 museum employees formed this union. One of their mottos today is, because you can't eat prestige. So the Art Workers Coalition had an impact, tremendous impact.
That's Nicholas Lampert, and there's much more information and many more stories in his book, A People's Art History of the United States. I'm CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.